Thank you, Ray, for leading those songs. I ask that Ray lead us in those particular songs, some of them at least, and he then augmented that list and filled it out to a complete list of songs that impress upon us Gentiles our Hebrew heritage. I'm not sure what your thinking is toward you as a Gentile being a disciple of a Hebrew Messiah. I personally would not trade my heritage as a Christian. If I know my own heart, and I believe that I do, I would not trade it for my life. But at the same time, I'm aware of the fact that I am a Gentile by stock and not a Hebrew by stock. I feel like a wild olive grafted into a tame olive tree. And I don't know how you as a Gentile can feel any different, because that's what you are. And I want to emphasize our Hebrew heritage because of the fact that I'm confident that in order to project the lessons for the next few weeks into the vein of thinking that I feel like we need to explore, we'll need to get an historical perspective. For the next few weeks, we're going to be studying and preparing ourselves in terms of specifics on how to communicate Jesus of Nazareth to an unbelieving world. And secondly, how to, in any community where we find ourselves, to successfully establish the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ to where it will be a functioning, living organism and serve as His representatives on earth. But I feel in order to do that, we must gain this historical perspective. I think we need to see clearly our Hebrew roots. Now, the historical perspective that we gained, I hope we gained or touched upon last semester, had to do with the church. And we took a look at history, noticing the various aspects of the church that could be documented both in the scriptures and in secular history. And I want us to do that this coming few weeks as it pertains to Jesus Himself. We need to stand back far enough from this thing of Christianity to see it in its true perspective. We are Gentiles who have willingly become followers of a Jewish Messiah. And I think it does us good to take stock and see exactly what our relationship to Him is. Because one of the hurdles that you and I will have to clear in any successful attempt to communicate Jesus of Nazareth to a lost world, any such attempt as that, if it succeeds, will have to grapple with and clear this hurdle that will be thrown up to you, the objection that says that Jesus was actually rejected by His own people, that you're following a Messiah that His own people didn't even accept. 60 years after Jesus had lived and had been executed by the Romans, one of His disciples, John, wrote and said He came to His own, but His own didn't receive Him. And he acknowledged that which was all too obvious to an unbelieving world. For by the end of that 60-year period after Jesus' death, there were virtually no Jews who were adherents to the gospel. Now, that's not completely true, because there have been, and there were at that time, a few Jews even who were still following Jesus. But the vast majority of the membership of the body of Christ at that time that John wrote consisted of Gentile people. It seems that his unwillingness to come down from the cross, which they interpreted as his inability to come down from the cross, was all the evidence that they needed to at least momentarily justify their having crucified him. The rulers made sport of it. They wagged their heads and marched up and down in front of him and said, "If you're the Christ, come on down from the cross. We'll believe on you." They issued him ultimatums. They issued him insinuations or threw innuendos at him. You who were going to save other people, you can't even save yourself. But they were saying more or less, "We're open-minded. Come down off the cross. We'll believe on you." The ones who were executed with him, they threw the same insults at him. "If you're the Christ, for goodness sakes, do something. Get us down from here." And his unwillingness to do that was simply fuel for the fires of opposition. And they went off feeling justified. Yes, we're right. We should have killed him. He was an imposter. He should not have been allowed to live. One historian, in conjunction with the actions of the Jews, trying to reconcile it with common sense, one historian says that there is not a single thread of evidence that the Jews of Jesus' day had any idea whatsoever that a martyred Christ was a part of God's plan. Now, do you follow what I'm saying? You understand what I meant by that? That there is no evidence, and he had searched diligently. He said, "I find no evidence in the writings and in the mind of the Jew of Jesus' day, that the ordinary Jew, or any Jew really," he said, "had any inkling whatsoever that a martyred Christ, a killed Christ, had any part in God's plan." And I find this difficult to understand, and yet I'm confident that it's true. When we find the disciples of Jesus themselves rejecting this idea of a martyred Christ, in the lesson this morning, you remember, Jesus took his disciples aside and said, "Now, I've got to go to Jerusalem and be mistreated and killed and raised the third day." Peter said, "Lord, this is not going to happen to you. We're not going to let it." They weren't at all prepared for this idea. Just prior to his death, probably on Wednesday before he was crucified on Friday morning, Jesus was in conversation with a group of people that might be called disciples on the perimeter or on the fringe area. And they were still conversing with him, and he said, "I must be lifted up. When I am lifted up, you'll know that I'm he." And they said, "Well, what do you mean lifted up? We thought that the Christ abides forever. We've heard that he does. What do you mean that the Son of Man must be lifted up?" So there again, a reflection that they didn't understand that the lifting up of the Christ was in the plan of God. Peter later on told the Jews, "I know that in ignorance you did it." And then after his crucifixion, on Sunday afternoon, when the two men were on their way back to Emmaus, and Jesus went along with them and asked them what they were so seriously talking about. And they said, "About Jesus of Nazareth. The things about him." And he said, "What things?" And they said, "Man, are you the only visitor to Jerusalem that doesn't know what's happened there?" And then they told him about how that this man had been a man mighty in deed and word, and yet he'd been betrayed and crucified. And they shook their head in dismay and said, "We had hoped that he would be the one to redeem Israel." But that particular tense of the verb, you know what it carries with it, "we had hoped." What despondency. They just didn't understand. Now, this unawareness to me is almost incredible. In the light of the messianic prophecies in the Old Testament, it is incredible to me, a Gentile, looking at it through 2,000 years of fulfillment, it seems incredible to me that they could have known their own prophecies and not been aware of this part of God's plan. Isaiah 53. Even if you take that passage and say, "Well, it's too ambiguous. We can't specifically say what it says. We think it means the whole nation of Israel, that is the suffering servant." Well, even so, it was recognized as a messianic prophecy of the coming of the Messiah of the Christ. But there's another passage that cannot be dismissed so lightly, and that is found in Daniel, the 9th chapter. I want you to turn there tonight, and we're going to notice 3 verses. In Daniel, the 9th chapter, you know who Daniel was, of course. He was one of the original Hebrew children taken into captivity in Babylon, along with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And at the time of the writing of the book of Daniel, at the writing of the 9th chapter, at least the events that the 9th chapter records, took place in the 68th year of the Babylonian captivity. The 68th year. Chapter 9 begins by telling us that Daniel had been reading in the prophet Jeremiah. They carried these books of theirs with them everywhere they went. They were fanatics about it. Daniel had been spending some time reading in the prophet Jeremiah. The second verse says, in the first year of his reign, that is of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, I, Daniel, understood from the books the number of years which, according to the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet, must pass by before the desolations which had been pronounced on Jerusalem should end. And it was 70 years. Now, if you want to know where Daniel was reading, what exact reference and what exact page he had his hand on, you'll find in Jeremiah, the 25th chapter, verses 10, 11, and 12, and then Jeremiah 29, verse 10, and perhaps another one in chapter 31, verses 38 through 40. Daniel had been reading those particular passages. And in those passages, it just simply says that the number of years that would have to elapse before the Babylonian captivity was finished, the number was 70 years. Now, as I said, 68 of those years had already passed by. And now here was this man on the threshold of the final fulfillment. The rest of the chapter, verses 3 through verse 19, rather, those next few verses there, contain a prayer of Daniel asking that God go ahead and reveal to him what were the particulars about their deliverance, and when would they be brought back into the city of Jerusalem, and when would its restoration and the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem take place. While he was praying, the angel of God, who is God's, one of his major men, one of his major messengers, we should say, Gabriel, was sent by God to Daniel to take a message to him. And the message that he brought to Daniel, it says, he instructed me and made me understand, this is in verse 22, he made me understand, he talked with me and said, O Daniel, I'm now come forth to give you skill and wisdom and understanding. At the beginning of your prayers, the word went forth, and I have come to tell you, for you are greatly beloved. Therefore, consider the matter and understand the vision. And so he began to give Daniel some full information, some specific information regarding these questions that were bearing on Daniel's mind. Actually, Daniel had interest only in one question. He wanted to know just simply how long it was going to be before they got to go home. Had you been in a foreign country for 70 years or 68 years and you knew that it was coming to an end, you'd be getting excited too, and Daniel was becoming excited. And so the information that he gave to Daniel is found here in verses 24 through 26. Therefore consider the matter and understand the vision. 70 weeks of years are decreed upon your people and upon your holy city, Jerusalem, to finish and put an end to transgression, to seal up and make full the measure of sin, to purge away and make expiation and reconciliation for sin, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint a holy of holies. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem until the coming of the anointed one, a prince, shall be 7 weeks of years, plus 62 weeks of years. It shall be built again with city square and moat, but in troublous times. And after the 62 weeks of years shall the anointed one be cut off or killed, and shall have nothing and no one belonging to and defending him. Now that's unbelievable. It's unbelievably specific. It's undeniably clear. And you and I think, can see something in here that will help us understand just how minute was the detail that God used in bringing about the coming of the Christ. There are three or four things that he mentions in here. We're going to only notice one. But the three or four things that he tells Daniel that will take place are these: the time of the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem, how long it would take. We're told also the coming of the Christ, when he would come, what would be the nature of his work. And then there's more or less a postscript after this particular statement here. And in this, Daniel is told of the coming of the destruction of Jerusalem by Titus, the Roman general, in A.D. 70. He tells this in the middle part of verse 26, and the people of the other prince, and the word other there is inserted, but the people of the other prince is what it refers to, who shall come, he will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood, and even to the end there shall be war, and desolations are decreed. And he shall enter into a strong and firm covenant with the many for 1 week, 7 years. And in the midst of the week he shall cause all the sacrifices and the offerings to cease for the remaining 3.5 years. And upon the wing or pinnacle of abominations shall come one who makes desolate until the full determined end is poured out on the desolator. So these four things he reveals to Daniel. Daniel really didn't want to know but about one of them. But he tells them these four. We're going to be concerned with just one of those, and that is the time of the coming of Christ. Look in verse 24. He gives the time of the coming of Christ and puts it in terms of weeks of years. 70 weeks of years are decreed upon your people and upon your holy city, Jerusalem, to finish and put an end to transgression. And he goes ahead and names what all is going to happen. In this verse, he uses an expression. Do you know how many days 70 weeks would be? How many days would 70 weeks be, Van? 490 days. But this is not just literally days. This is apocalyptic language. In other words, it's language that has a covering over it. It's been obscured. You see, the Jews were forever getting the stuffing beat out of them by some other nation of people. They were always getting knocked down, and people were always after their writings, trying to destroy their writings, because they looked at these people as religious nuts. And they knew how completely fanatical they were about these writings of theirs, writings that they considered radioactive. They would see the Jews, after handling the scriptures, go and wash their hands because they had touched something that we would call something that was actually radioactive. It was so live, and the people would look at them like they were nuts. And they were forever trying to destroy these writings. So whenever they would come in and conquer, the Jewish people, in order to protect these things, in order to protect their own necks, put their writings, and God described these things in what we call apocalyptic language. In other words, it said something, but it was not exactly like that. It was a figurative language. Whenever he spoke of 70 weeks of years, as the prophet Ezekiel talks in chapter 4 and verse 6, Ezekiel describes it and says 70 weeks really means 70 weeks of years. So 490 days, 70 weeks, literally, in apocalyptic language, once it's been brought out into the open, means 490 years. So what he's saying here, that within a span of 490 years, there was going to happen a series of things. Number one, your city would be rebuilt and you'd be restored to it. Number two, your Christ was going to come. Number three, your Christ is going to be killed. Now, he said, you can look for these three things to happen within this period of 490 years. But the obvious question is, when is it going to start? Lord, I understand 490 years, but now when am I supposed to start counting? That's found in verse 25. Know, therefore, and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem, from that point until the coming of the Anointed One, and that word in the ancient text, the Greek text, the Septuagint, that word is the Christ. From the going forth of the edict to rebuild Jerusalem until the coming of the Christ will be 490 years, 70 weeks. But he divides it up in these particular ways. He says, first of all, from this decree, you can start counting. But from what decree? There were four of them. There were four specific decrees issued by the Medo-Persian conglomerate kingdom. One of these was by Cyrus the Great. That was in 538. And you'll find a reference to it in Ezra chapter 1 and verse 2. The second one of these decrees to rebuild Jerusalem came from Darius Hystaspes, and that was in B.C. 519. The third one of these was issued by Artaxerxes Longimanus, and that was in 457 to 458 B.C., though in that year. And then a fourth was also issued by Artaxerxes Longimanus in B.C. 445. Now, all of these can be found in Ezra chapter 1, Ezra chapter 6, Ezra chapter 7, and in Nehemiah chapter 1. These four decrees actually, you see, span a period of about 93 years, almost a century, from the beginning of this one till the end of this other issue or this other edict. So a Jew could look at that and say, well, perhaps the closest I can come would be within 100 years. But bless your heart, he could have at least come within 100 years of it. And he could have checked out, he might not have known which one of those decrees God was referring to when he said, from this edict, you can count 490 years until your Christ comes. But they could have understood that it would be within 93-year span. There was a leeway of 93 years, but that was close enough for them to have pinpointed it within the century. That's why I can't understand why they were not able to do it. Actually, the one from which we can accurately date the coming of Christ is the first one that Artaxerxes Longimanus wrote or issued in 457 to 458. Do you know who he was, this Artaxerxes Longimanus? He is the Ahasuerus of Daniel and of Esther. This was Esther's husband. This was Esther's husband. You remember Vashti had been turned out to pasture by old Ahasuerus when she wouldn't parade up and down in front of these kings. He just dismissed her and turned her out. And then he chose another queen, and he chose Esther. And this was the man who chose Esther, who issued the edict from which the date was set 490 years later was coming the Christ. In 1970, when we came back through Europe on the way home from overseas, we went through Athens, Greece, and we saw the great Areopagus and the Parthenon, the buildings sitting up on the hill. And one night, we went over onto another hill where there were benches and a theater where you could sit on the side of this hill and you could look over at the great Areopagus hill, and you could see all of the great buildings that had been such a prominent part of history. And there was what they called a light and sound show. And we were just thrilled at part of the report, part of the show, whenever the spotlight was located on one particular wall, which was on our left, which I think probably was the southwest wall. I'm not sure. But the spotlight lit on that wall, and the announcer, as matter-of-factly, simply said, this is the wall which Ahasuerus breached in such and such a year when the forces of Ahasuerus came against the forces of Athens, Greece, and overcame the forces there and took the city of Athens. And I thought, well, what about that? And that was the wife, that was the husband of Esther. But anyway, it was from that date, he said, that you can count these years. Now, having established that, watch what he's saying. He divides it into two parts. Number one, he says there's a period of 7 weeks. 7 weeks of years would be how many years? 7 weeks would be how many days? 49. Good boy. Okay, Holder. 49. That's right. 49 weeks would be 7 weeks would be 49 days. 49 weeks of years would be 49 years. Now this, he says, is the length of time that it will take you to rebuild the city. That took place during the years 457 B.C. to 408 B.C. during the years of the reign, or during the years in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. And you can read Ezra and Nehemiah and get all of those, the information that has to do with the rebuilding of the city, the rebuilding of the wall, the reinstituting of the religious institutions and all there in the city of Jerusalem. It took 49 years to accomplish it. Then he says, after that edict to rebuild the city, when 49 years have taken place, the city will be built again with a moat around it. It'll have its own square and courthouse and that sort of thing. And then he says there's another period of 62 weeks, which amounts to 434 years. From that time of the completion of the moat and the city square in Jerusalem, you can count 434 years. Now listen, this is specific. They could go back in their well-documented chronicles of the kings, and they could know exactly the year that the moat and that the city square of Jerusalem was restored under these men. He says 434 years from that date, your Christ will come. And you know what 434 years from 408 is? A.D. 26. Do you know what happened in the year A.D. 26? Jesus began his personal ministry. Well, look at verse 26. And after the 62 weeks, now watch what you've got. You've got 7 weeks, that's 49 years. 62 more weeks, 434 years, but let's just keep it in weeks. 7 weeks and 62 weeks, you see, is just 69 weeks. That, according to the accurate calculations, brings you up to A.D. 26. Then verse 26 here takes over and says, now after the 62 weeks, in other words, in the 70th week, shall the Christ be cut off or killed, and shall have nothing and no one belonging to him and defending him. Now you just don't get any more specific than that. That's why I say I cannot understand why the Jewish people rejected their own Messiah when there are such clear prophecies as this. And there's nothing more clear. This is the most explicit, I think, of all the prophecies in the Old Testament regarding the coming of the Christ. But it's there. And I checked it one day to make sure. I didn't know, but I suspected that whenever I saw the word, the Anointed One, I said, I'll just bet that in the Septuagint, that's the word Christ. And I went back there and my heart jumped when I saw the word Christus, that this number of years after the edict to rebuild Jerusalem, your Christ, your Messiah, will come. And the year after that 69th week of years, he'll be killed. So I'm finding myself increasingly and again continually mystified as to why they couldn't understand. And yet their hearts were hardened and their eyes were blinded, their ears were dulled. And Isaiah asks prophetically, Lord, who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a tender plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had no form nor comeliness. There was no beauty about him that we should desire him. It says we did not recognize him. And the psalmist said that the stone that the builders rejected has become the head of the corner. This is the Lord's doing, and it's marvelous in our eyes. Alfred Edersheim, in his great work on the life and times of Jesus, I couldn't find my copy. My boys have it, but I found another copy of something else that quoted it. So I want to read you just a very brief quotation. Alfred Edersheim, a converted Jew, in making comment on this Messiah of Jesus, he says, quote, if he is not the Messiah, he has at least done the Messiah's work. If he is not the Messiah, there has at least been none other before or after him. If he is not the Messiah, the world has not and never can have a Messiah. So you see, we're sitting today in what I believe, and it doesn't matter really what I believe, and nothing depends upon this statement, but we're sitting in what I believe to be the very tail end of history. I believe that the whole universe is being wound up to a final conclusion. I don't know how long it'll be. But I know this, that we sit here tonight as the happy recipients of the great advantages and blessings of a Jewish Messiah that God prepared even before the foundation of the world, created this nation of very strange people, and out of them brought his own Son, that he might be a light to the Gentiles and that we might have our hope placed in him. Tonight I stand before you as one who has placed his hope in the Lord Jesus Christ, and you sit tonight as one who has done the same thing. Let's not trade our heritage for anything, and let's recognize that we are members of something the historical scope of which has never been excelled by any other thing that's ever happened in the history of the human race. We're a part of that. Thank God we're a part of that. Are you a part of it? Some of you are not. Some of you have not come to the point in your faith where you're willing to commit yourself to this Jewish Messiah. I believe that he was God in the flesh. What about you? It takes faith. If you believe that, would you tonight simply step out into the aisle, do him the honor of accepting him, do yourself the honor of accepting him. In the simplest manner, come in faith, turn your back upon sin, be immersed into water, into his death, and be raised to walk in newness of life, and be a follower of this one who is the very center of all of the history of the human race. Jesus of Nazareth, how magnificent he is. Let's be about our business. May God bless us. Will you respond to him while we sing?
While we pray and while we plead, while you see your soul's deep need,